Hello and welcome to Monocle 24's The Urbanist, the show all about the cities we live in. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up on today's program.
The city has really transformed, and the experience of being in the city has changed quite dramatically in the last few months. When you go down the streets, there's just a lot more activity and outdoor activation of different streets and corridors, and the city just feels a lot more alive.
Despite this being a year marked by lockdowns and confinement in many parts of the world, people have never eaten outdoors as much as in 2020. The pandemic prompted businesses in many cities to spill out onto the streets to allow for social distances and force others to rethink their public spaces and always put people first. From reclaiming street space from cars to issuing an unprecedented number of permits for restaurants to open outdoors, this week we look at how 2020 has been defined by alfresco dining and street eateries. And also wonder what lies ahead for many of these solutions as the winter approaches here in the Northern Hemisphere. That's all coming up on The Urbanist with me, Andrew Tuck. So, welcome to this week's episode. We start today in New York. Similarly to most cities around the world, businesses were hard hit by the pandemic, which in many cases meant neighbourhoods were at risk of losing their meeting points and places where the community comes together. In response to this unique challenge, the Urban Design Forum and the Van Allen Institute partnered to create a new initiative called Neighbourhoods Now. Working together pro bono with design firms, they put together a set of community-driven recovery strategies for restaurants and eateries in the city. To find out more about this, I was joined by Deborah Martin and also by David Brown. Deborah is Van Allen's executive director, and she led the overall development of the Neighbourhoods Now programme. And David Brown is a principal architect at Woods Bagot, one of the firms participating in this initiative. Welcome both to The Urbanist. Deborah, if we could start with you. Neighbourhoods Now has been about connecting neighbourhoods impacted by COVID-19 and bringing in design messaging to offer solutions. What did you see as the vital thing that Neighbourhoods Now was doing for the communities that it's trying to support?
I think people are aware that when the pandemic hit in New York, what became very quickly, very painfully clear was that the neighborhoods that were the hardest hit with the highest rate of COVID infection were almost exactly overlapping with communities in our city that have suffered from other problems over time, inequities in terms of high poverty rates in those communities, and also a very high density of first responders and essential workers who lived in those communities. So Van Allen Institute exists to create equitable cities through inclusive design. And our desire always is to partner with communities and ask them, what help do you need right now? And what can the design community, as the Urban Design Forum and Van Allen Institute are both organizations rooted in design, Van Allen Institute for 126 years, what support do you need? So our first step for Neighborhoods Now was really to reach out to organizations that have some purview over the public realm or some agency over the public realm in these hard-hit communities and see who wanted to opt in. And we ended up with five different community partners in the very kind of neighborhoods that have been suffering from inequity, communities of color largely, for decades. And that was a Bed-Stuy in Brooklyn, Kingsbridge Road in the North Bronx, Jackson Heights in Queens, and Washington Heights in Northern Manhattan. So what we did quickly was we reached out to the networks of Urban Design Forum and Van Allen, which are at the core of them, architecture firms like David's firm, Woods Bagot, and then also engineering firms, landscape architecture, planning, all of the kind of urbanist fields. But we understood that that wasn't going to be enough, because regulations were changing very quickly. We understood that signage was needed. We understood that a lot of the design was going to be driven by public health, and kind of thinking around public health was evolving super fast, of like how far apart you need to be. I mean, now it seems inconceivable that people were hearing at the beginning that you don't need to wear masks. Then we do need to wear masks. So then signage need to reflect that. Everything was changing quickly. We also understood that there was going to be a need for sort of financial literacy And so we brought in not just the design firms, but all of the kind of infrastructural resources that would need to be brought to bear so that the communities that we were working with could actually avail themselves of the designs that the teams came up with. And I'll give you just one example of what I mean by that. In one of the communities that we worked, we were told by the leader of the bedside bid, a woman named Medina Sadek, that her restaurant owners, who are part of the bid, the Business Improvement District, they wanted to build some of the kind of ingenious and low-cost barriers like the ones that David and his firm came up with. But there was too much kind of antagonism between the small business owners and the landlords, who in this community are like small landlords who own maybe one or two buildings. And what she really needed was a landlord-tenant mediation workshop in the open air, right? Because nobody's going into an office. And in this community, there's a digital divide. And she knew that her constituents largely would either not have reliable Wi-Fi access or wouldn't have the language skills. And she felt like coming to some agreement around what were the norms of rent reduction so that businesses could continue to pay some rent so that landlords could continue to service their mortgage, that was a kind of condition precedent to even being able to build anything.
One of the interesting things when you look at the number of partnerships you have going, so you have obviously these partnerships in the communities, but just the organizations and brands and companies that have come on board to help you. Is this because people were protective about New York, because it's more in the American system of being philanthropic and stepping forward in these moments, you know, that there isn't the social security net you would see in some other countries? Is it just more a tradition of doing it? It looks extraordinary, the number of people who have stepped up to the plate to try and help you at this time.
It has been extraordinary, and something that when I think about it, it just kind of makes my heart crack because, you know, firms like David's, just to give you some numbers, within 6 weeks, we had mobilized more than 65 firms to organize into 5 working groups, more than 30 experts on particular areas like public health. That's a total of around 200 people. And to date, the professional in-kind services, not to mention free materials, we estimate is around hovering around $2 million worth of just free services contributed by the designers and the other professionals who are supporting us. So you ask why? I guess I would start with the fact that New York is an immensely diverse city, and we like it that way. And New Yorkers are immensely generous. In general, New York has an incredibly generous philanthropic community, and designers in particular, I think, you don't get into design if you're not a dreamer on some level and you don't want to make a better world. Every designer I know, and I include myself in that category, on some level trained for that career and pursued it because we want to see a better world. So I think that the combination of the sort of DNA of designers, the fact that it's New York City, where we understand that the core of our city is diversity, and we know that equity is not where we want it to be, but we know that, and we're trying to address it. We all want to work to address it. And the fact that there was a pandemic, and we saw our neighbors falling ill around us, it was that combination of factors, I think, that led to this extraordinary mobilization.
Well, let's bring in David. David, you're a principal architect at Woods Bagot. You're one of those companies that's heeded the call to roll up your sleeves and get involved. And in partnership with, I know, some other companies such as Arup, you're looking at this winterized outdoor dining solution. Now, what's interesting is when you look at this, you know, lots of restaurants are wondering how they get through the winter. The summer was a bit easy with, you know, just putting some stools or chairs out in the street. But now we come to winter. What were the demands that faced you when you began to think about this concept? And what's the neighborhood that you're partnering with?
Sure. So I'll start with the neighborhood first. So we're partnering with the Washington Heights neighborhood, and in particular, the Community League of the Heights is the community organization that we've been working with the most. And Arup was the coordinating firm for our neighborhood. And we've worked with some really great colleagues from other firms that have also brought a lot of great ideas to the table for different typologies that we're looking at. And we worked really collaboratively and sort of developed a lot of the ideas together on a lot of different fronts, which was a really great experience. For the restaurant typology, what we realized early on was that there was a horizon of sort of September, October, and the early days of pandemic response. And that was really all that the mayor of New York, their team had created this open restaurants framework and allowed people to start building structures in front of their restaurants to have outdoor dining. But they'd only allowed it up until the end of September, and then it got extended to the end of October. But we all were anticipating that this need would be more long-term and businesses could get really adversely affected in the winter when they would not be able to go inside and that there could potentially be a second wave and all of that. So we started to think about that kind of longer-term solution, which is why we came up with the idea of doing the winterized kiosk or restaurant, which we really began developing in July of this year before we even knew it would be legally possible. But we thought that maybe we could actually kind of help frame the conversation around the ability to have longer-term outdoor dining solutions. So some of the challenges that we faced just from a technical perspective was, how do we create a space that could be warm and be actually be usable through the winter, but would still allow kind of open airflow and allow the kind of indoor air to get out so that we wouldn't be trapping air inside? And I think that's a lot of the criticism now that people have for some of the restaurants that are being built already outside, is that they're actually very closed in and people are asking, why is this any different from eating inside? So we were trying to find a solution that would allow to both block the wind, to let the indoor air kind of filter out, to allow the space to be heated with heat lamps, and also to allow the space to be heated kind of passively through radiation from the sun coming in through the roof. So we developed an idea of creating this double layer skin that would be staggered in such a way to allow kind of air to flow out, but not really allow the cold air to, particularly wind-driven air, to kind of come into the space.
And also, I guess the other interesting thing is, you know, that most design commissions come with some notion of the durability needed, the longevity that's in mind for a project. Here, you don't know whether it's for one winter, potentially two winters. And also for, especially for restaurants, which are, we're not talking about grand establishments, we're talking about community restaurants. I guess there's a real pressure to deliver beauty at a budget that these people can afford and that you can afford and that the backers can make this happen without spending a load of money that then gets pulled down and thrown away perhaps in months' time.
On that front, some of the economic challenges that we faced were, actually it wasn't even the economic challenge, it was a perception that restaurants had that if they were only going to be able to build something for 2 or 3 months, a lot of them weren't willing to make that investment and a lot of them just couldn't afford to make that investment. But once we started talking to them about a longer term solution, and then the city extended the open restaurants to be year round, then they were more open to the possibility of doing it. So there is that issue of, you know, how much the investment is going to pay off and for how long you can actually use it. But on the economic front, what we came up with was an idea. We called it the flat pack solution. It's, you know, inspired by IKEA furniture in the sense that a lot of the components we're trying to make are very repetitive. They can be cut off site and then easily shipped to site and installed in a very easy way. So we wanted to make it something that any layperson could do and that you wouldn't really require contractors to come in and help you put it together. But it would be something that either we could help volunteering with the restaurants to put it together, or the restaurant owners could kind of do it themselves. So we wanted to kind of help reduce the labor costs on that front and make it, you know, easier to fabricate and also kind of easier to ship, because you don't want to have to sort of bring in big trucks and things like that for a lot of prefabricated components. The idea that it could be made out of, you know, really simple material, off-the-shelf plywood, be cut off site, kind of brought on in a very quick and easy way and installed very quickly, we thought would be a value add to owners. Because we went up to the neighborhood every weekend for a few weeks, and we just saw that even the restaurants that had the means to build these structures, it still took them 2 or 3 weeks to actually get it completely finished. And every week we'd go, we kind of see a little bit more progress. So 2 or 3 weeks, some of these restaurants too, is a lot of revenue that they could be getting. So we felt like the quicker we can help them install it, the faster they can get things kind of up and running. And that would also help them out financially.
Deborah, you're almost like design first responders here, coming to an emergency situation. But what's, again, interesting about many of the projects that you're looking at, you know, there are ideas for turning empty lots into arts centers or into auditoria, outdoor auditoria. There are ideas for taking large spaces and making them safer for smaller events. There's a lot of dreaming going on as well. Were you surprised as the projects came along that people weren't just thinking about what was vital for this second to get you through this moment, but began to reimagine the city of the future as well?
No, I wasn't surprised by that at all. And I think, you know, what we realized and what was one of the wonderful things that came out of this response to this horrible tragedy is that the communities that we worked with very often don't have the resources to connect with the kind of really extraordinary creativity that firms like David's or the other lead firms like Moody Nolan, KPF, Arup, Sowell, Cook Fox, the lead firms, and all of the supporting firms as well. They just don't connect with these communities because by and large, they don't have the resources to purchase these kind of services. So there was a kind of excited creativity that happened when these connections were made, because it's not that the designers aren't aware that there's a lack of equity and there's like long-term kind of systemic and public realm and even cultural, institutional kinds of challenges that would benefit from really excellent design thinking. It's just there wasn't the context for that connection to happen. And so it's unfortunate that the context turns out to have been a pandemic, you know, but we're hopeful and we're already seeing that some of the relationships that were started in the context of this disaster are developing legs and perhaps will persist past this moment.
David, perhaps we could end with you. Has it changed the city for you? Has it made you dream a little bit more about what New York could be, what its neighborhoods could be? How has this project influenced your thinking?
I think it's influenced our thinking on a number of different fronts. I think one of them is what Deborah was just describing, which is this amazing coming together of all these different design firms and groups that were really rallying around this challenge and coming up with responses. And the amount of collaboration and collegiality between everyone was really impressive. And we learned a ton from our colleagues and our working group, you know, that was really focused on restaurants and some of the challenges they were facing in their neighborhoods, and from our group that was focused on Washington Heights. So I think that was sort of one thing, just to see this amazing solidarity and approach to challenges that the city faces. Just to me, it becomes a model that we can use in the future for other acute kind of challenges like this, but also kind of longer term and more systemic challenges that we face. And I think that's also why people were focused on these kind of bigger ideas, also because this pandemic just made a lot more of these systemic challenges more known and more present. So we wanted to kind of think about them as well. So I think the other part about it is, you know, through a lot of these, you know, specifically with restaurants and the open streets, the city has really transformed. And, you know, the experience of being in the city has changed quite dramatically in the last few months. When you go down the streets, there's just a lot more activity and outdoor activation of different streets and corridors. And the city just feels a lot more alive, actually, even though we're going through this really sort of challenging time. So I think that gives a lot of hope to what we see for the future of the city and how people are coming together and are still supporting their communities and finding new communities and new ways of outreach and coming together. So I think that that's a really beautiful thing to see, that that's our response to the challenge of the pandemic, is actually to make our city even better. So I think that just gives a lot of hope for the future.
David Brown, Principal Architect at Woods Bagot, and Deborah Martin, Van Allen's Executive Director there. Thank you for joining us on The Urbanist. Up next, we head to Italy to see how to build a city around alfresco dining. Stay with us. While many places are entering a brave new world when it comes to outdoor dining, cities in the Mediterranean appear to have been literally built around the idea of streets being a place to gather, meet, eat, and be merry. So what lessons can we learn from those more accustomed to well-fed revelers and romantic rendezvous dotting the streets? Monocle's Chiara Rimella, who grew up in the alfresco utopia of Italy, tells us more.
If you need proof of the fact that Italy is amongst the most skilled countries in the world at the art of eating outdoors, consider this. The words used in English to refer to the act of dining under the stars are borrowed straight from Italian. Alfresco, that's how people refer to it for short. In my mother tongue, that translates to in the cold, which, for all those people still allowed to eat in restaurants this winter, may well feel very accurate. What you may not know is that, back in the Bel Paese, that's not really how we refer to pulling up a chair at a table on a pavement. In fact, if we use the words literally, that will mean keeping something chilled, and in its metaphorical sense, the expression actually means spending time in prison, where I believe the food served is not quite as nice as going to a trattoria. So when booking a table in Italy, what you want to be requesting is a table all'aperto, which in turn means in the open. Perhaps it's just a linguistic coincidence, but it's an interesting one. The idea of openness and transparency applies well to public space. Eating out, even when you're sitting inside a restaurant, is always something of a performance, not just for whoever you might be going on a date with, but for all the other people in the room too. Transfer that approach to a table set on a cobblestone piazza and you'll soon realise that eating all'aperto is in many ways a parade. Like much of the activity that takes place in an Italian square, it's an act of community building, a slice of public life. This outward-facing aspect of Italian behaviour is only one of the main reasons why eating outdoors is so popular in the country. The other, of course, has got to do with the weather. During much of spring and summer, the nation is blessed with glorious sunshine, so much so that many restaurants are equipped with umbrellas, not as preventive measures against the rain, but to offer punters some shade in the unforgiving midday heat. Take a stroll along the coast in a seaside resort town from Liguria to Sardinia, and you'll soon notice that many restaurants barely bother with having indoor seating space, their tables sprawling onto the passeggiata instead. In fact, calling up for a reservation in the summer months will almost inevitably land you with a table outdoors by default. Sitting indoors would be a buzzkill and very inconvenient for the many Italians who are devoted smokers. Come August, in the deserted but dutifully prepped dining rooms, you'll only find some solitary family who's all too keen on the air conditioning. Still, another reason why dinners outdoors are so popular in Italy has got to do with the country's cities and their urbanistic nature too. A good weather nation plans and builds accordingly. Terraces and courtyards are common features for many palazzos and are easily converted into hospitality ventures. Like their Middle European counterparts across the Alps, northern Italian cities feature plenty of arcades where sitting is possible even during the colder, wetter months. Turin and Bologna are famous for their kilometres of porticos. And thanks to well-preserved historical centres, plenty of other cities have neighbourhoods that have either remained traffic-free or are, at least, pedestrian-friendly, which means tables can spill out on the streets instead. After all, Venice was never really made for cars, and canny restaurateurs will find a way to squeeze tables even in the most narrow of canal sides. Lockdown permitting, there's talk in Italy of extending permits that would allow restaurants to take up extra space on the streets for free into next year. Here, like any other country in which similar discussions are taking place, this would be good news. But Italian restaurants have habits already on their side, and as soon as the cold winter air gives way to the enticing summer breeze, eating al fresco will be a joy again.
Our thanks there to Monocle's culture editor, Chiara Rimella. Outdoor dining is already presenting a number of challenges for many cities around the globe that are less familiar with the concept. Now, as the air gets colder, many restaurants are forced to tackle the challenge of keeping their patrons warm too. And simply plonking down an outdoor heater may not be the easy solution that it seems. Unsurprisingly, perhaps, Australia's got a pretty good track record of people dining outside all year round, even in winter. So as cities in the Northern Hemisphere, from Seattle to Zurich, look to encourage people to stay outside in the colder months, what can we learn from down under? This show's producer, Carlo Tarabello, caught up in studio with Nick Manise, our resident Aussie and former urban designer who helped write the City of Perth's outdoor dining guidelines. Carlo began by asking why some cities in Europe and North America are actually opposed to outdoor heaters.
What's interesting is that heaters generally in Australia are permitted by cities, like, and it's just a common sense approach. I think Zurich's logic was that they wanted their heaters to be sustainably powered, and I think that's a good thing, that makes sense. But it obviously instantly rules out gas heaters, and I think it also appears that infrared heaters or electric heaters are also being struck through as well. And I think these environmental concerns in Zurich and other cities in the Northern Hemisphere, they're legitimate. But I mean, given the current environment, it does seem a little bit, particularly the current economic environment, it does seem a little bit aggressive. Like, I think businesses are going to have to rely on outdoor dining to help prop them up. So, and importantly as well, I think it also adds city life. It adds vibrancy. It is generally a good thing for cities. Like, you've got eyes on the street, you've got people on the street. There's that energy that comes from it. So keeping it in practice, keeping it rolling all year round in cities like Zurich and the Northern Hemisphere, where it's a little bit colder, could be good and could bring some human warmth to the streets in winter. So, I mean, that aside, environmentally, I'd argue that also having an electric heater outside is perhaps no different to having one inside, which is permitted. So it seems a little bit bizarre to me. I don't know how you feel on that one, but it does seem a little bit heavy-handed. And I think where they could learn from perhaps Australia, and I kind of love this because we're always looking to Europe and North America for inspiration. So when Australia is doing something really well, I get quite excited.
This is your chance, Nick.
This is my chance. No, I can get on my pedestal here, because what they do, and it's written into all the guidelines of Australian cities from, you know, Adelaide to Melbourne to Perth as well, heaters are encouraged as long as they're compliant with relevant safety standards. It is just a common sense approach, you know, making sure that they're self-contained and stable and removed when they're not in use, and also tie in with appropriate, I guess, clearances, making sure that people can move through the streets comfortably. And I think that's one thing that feeds into outdoor dining more generally. And I see it a lot here. I mean, Australia as a whole is a little bit of a nanny state. We're quite aggressive on making sure people comply, but making sure there's enough room for people to comfortably move around items like heaters, but even tables and chairs, especially if you're in a wheelchair or have a pram, you know, having a whole footpath blocked off by outdoor dining, I think it's almost undemocratic, because we've got to remember that even though we're supporting businesses and it's a great commercial boon for the city for businesses to be able to be in these streets, we've got to remember that they're also public spaces and people need to be able to use them and move through them comfortably.
You mentioned there the environmental considerations, which we also saw earlier this year, the city of Paris, for example, saying that they will be banning outdoor heaters that do not meet certain criteria. And Paris being one of the cities on this side of the world that famously people eat out all year round, exactly because of that. So apart from the environmental side of the discussion, what are some other considerations we need to be taking into account here? You know, how do cities keep their streets looking attractive, interesting, and alluding to what you just mentioned, also uncluttered?
Yeah, I mean, for me, I think if we're going to particularly go with attractive, and maybe this could help shape the discussion around heaters, it's making sure that we're using quality materials. You know, it's like everything from the tables and chairs, maybe not being plastic, but something in steel or timber that is obviously weatherproofed as well and can stand up to being in these elements. I think that's really important in terms of the attractiveness thing, because for cities as well, they're spending a lot of money on making their public realms attractive and durable and hardy. And I think if you're just allowing businesses to put out rubbish elements in the street, I think that can detract from the city itself. But equally for the businesses as well, like if this is going to be a long-term investment, having something that's durable and sturdy and can stand the test of time and the test of this weather, I think that's really important. The clutter thing as well, I think just making sure that we're not covering our streets with drop-down awnings and huge shelters or windbreaks. Like, it is still a public space. We still want it to be public. We just want it to be a little bit more comfortable. So I think keeping elements to a minimum from a clutter perspective, keeping it to tables and chairs and heaters, and maybe a cleverly placed awning here or there, but certainly not covering the street with temporary pop-up tents, making sure that it still remains a public space, I think is important. And it is, weather aside, I mean, you still want people out there, but it is outdoors. And I think it's just leaning into that and making it as comfortable as you can within reason.
Do you feel then that businesses, by implementing proper guidelines for outdoor dining with all these considerations, can they add character to a city? I mean, we describe Italy often as a whole nation based on alfresco dining, but can it actually add character to a city?
Yeah, I think obviously there's that cultural element and having people out there. I mean, you mentioned Paris earlier as well, and there's that whole culture of sitting outside and watching people. So you've got that side of things. I mean, the other thing, and it does come back to clutter, and I'm obsessed with making sure that outdoor dining doesn't clutter our streets, it's making sure that the city is still visible and, you know, that we're not hiding the actual buildings that these outdoor dining areas are in front of with hoarding and advertising. And I mean, I'm partial to a Coca-Cola, but I certainly don't want to be walking past every shopfront having a tacky red and white or black and white Coca-Cola umbrella. I think we can still do it in a way that does make the city distinct and doesn't perhaps over-commercialise it or fill it up with clutter. And I think that's what I'm realising as we're having this discussion right now. I just hate clutter. Marie Kondo your streets when you're doing outdoor dining.
Monocle's Nick Manisa in conversation with Carlotta Ribello. Well, that's all for this edition of the programme. Today's episode was produced by Carlotta Ribello and David Stevens. And David also edited the show. And to pay you out of this week's episode, well, here's Sam Cooke with Out in the Cold Again. Thank you for listening, City Lovers. The song that
that you sang so sweetly. You called it our love refrain. Now it's gone and I'm left completely. Oh, I'm out in the cold again.